This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the Sunday, May 31st edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Craig Fife reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And we'll begin with the obituaries from the Sunday edition. Mr. Daniel J. Delvecchio, 64, of Grafton, passed away May 26th at home, surrounded by his loving family after a courageous battle with cancer. Funeral arrangements are under the direction of the Edwards Memorial Funeral Home, 44 Congress Street, Milford. Please visit www.edwardsmemorialfuneralhome.com for complete obituary and condolence book. That's EDWARDSMEMORIALFUNERALHOME. Wayne F. Bridges, 73, of Ashland, passed away Wednesday, May 13th. A funeral service will be celebrated Saturday, June 6th at 11 a.m. in the Chapel of the Matarese Funeral Home, 325 Main Street, Ashland. Visiting hours will be held Saturday prior from 9:30 to 11:30 a.m. Full notice and charitable information can be found at www.mataresefuneral.com. That's MATARESEFUNERAL. It is with shock and great sadness that we share the death of our sister, Gail Valley Blake, from a tragic car accident on April 30th. Visiting hours and a celebration of life is planned for Wednesday, June 10th at Everett Funeral Home, 4 Park Street, Natick. Visiting hours are 10:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Gathering to share memories and reflections from 11:30 to 12 p.m. Burial service will follow at St. Patrick's Cemetery, Natick. In lieu of flowers, please consider a donation in Gail's honor to Animal Refuge League of Portland, P.O. Box 336, Westbrook, Maine, 04098. For online guestbook and directions, please visit everettfuneral.com. That's EVERETTFUNERAL. Tammy M. Flanagan, 64, of Holliston, passed away unexpectedly on Wednesday, May 27th. Funeral arrangements are under the care of the Pickering and Son Upton Funeral Home in Upton. For her complete obituary and service details, please visit www.uptonfunerals.com. That's UPTONFUNERALS. And those are the obituaries from the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News. And now continuing with some local news. Wayland Garden Center celebrates 150 years. This story is by Carolyn Bunnell, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. A local institution that has survived wars, financial crises, and pandemics is marking a milestone few family businesses attain. Russell's Garden Center is celebrating 150 years in operation, a longevity its owners credit to constant adaptation and the unwavering loyalty of its customers. Located at 397 Post Road, Route 20, Russell's has become a year-round staple in Metro West and a go-to destination for plants, Christmas trees, flowers, and locally made goods sold both in its on-site store and its popular farmers markets. The business began in 1876 as Russell's Provisions, a small roadside farm stand opened by Samuel Lewis Russell in Old Wayland Center. As automobiles became more common, the family business expanded, opening a shop in 1925 and gradually adding vegetables, flowers, eggs, and Christmas trees. Over the decades, the operation grew into one of the largest garden centers in New England. Today, the center is run by fourth-generation owners Elizabeth Russell Skeen and Tim Skeen, along with their children, the fifth generation, Carly Windsor, a buyer for the center, and Dan Skeen, who serves as chief financial officer. Another fourth-generation family member, Jack Russell, also helps run the business by expanding product offerings and sharing horticultural expertise with customers. I have a big smile on my face every time somebody reads my T-shirt and goes, "Wow, 150 years, Russell Skeen said. I looked at everybody in the perennial yard, in the nursery yard, and all these families were walking around, and everybody was so happy and having so much fun. This is pretty cool. Our family came up with this." The fourth generation expanded year-round operations, adding gift and toy shops, as well as winter and summer farmers markets. The garden center has weathered many challenges, with perhaps the most disruptive, being the COVID-19 pandemic. Russell Skeen said the shutdown put the business under severe financial strain and forced decisions the family never imagined making. Dan Skeen said the business paused planting for the first time in its history because it didn't have the staff to care for crops, and the store was closed for all of April 2020. The operations manager warned that planting without certainty of reopening could push the business into deeper financial hardship. But when Russell's reopened, it quickly became a safe, spacious outdoor destination. Some customers came multiple times per week, with some starting gardens for the first time, and others turning to houseplants to brighten small apartments. "We couldn't foresee that we turned out to be a place where people love to come to be outside," Russell Skeen said. "There were a lot of bad things that happened, but there were a lot of good things that came out of COVID as well." Russell Skeen said the center's operations have always been shaped by major world events, including the introduction of trucks for distribution, technological shifts, the rise of big box stores, and changing customer buying trends. Each shift forced the family to rethink how they operated, what they grew, and how they connected with customers. "I feel like every generation has been persistent, but also stubbornly focused on being a place for our community and being here for our community through everything," Windsor said. "At this point, we have been through two world wars, the Great Depression, COVID, 2008. There has been so many different challenges, but you don't think of it as being 150 years. You think of it as every year. You're just doing the best you possibly can." The family emphasized that community support has been one of the main reasons they've endured. "We believe if you shop in your local community, then your community will lift you up," Tim Skeen said. Russell's is involved in local schools, employs local students, and aims to help the local economy thrive. The business also hopes to encourage families to spend more time outdoors and learn about gardening. "What's really cool and makes us really feel warm and fuzzy inside is when you see a family with grandparents, their kids, and their kids' kids, three generations," Windsor said. Excuse me. All of these little things that we do to make this space for our community and to support our community, they pay you back with coming and making these traditions here. Dan Skeen emphasized the importance of having knowledgeable employees, many of whom have been with the business for decades and have gained institutional knowledge to share with customers. We have a lot of people who are very passionate about the products we sell, but they also love the customers we serve, he said. They love working here. Skeen added that the dedication of the staff and their ability to push through challenges has been central to Russell's longevity. It's a hard industry to be in, he said. Not a lot of people are in planting for the money. It's more a way of life. Windsor said choosing to stay at Russell's is something every generation and every employee decides for themselves. It's a choice that every employee makes when they choose to continue to work here, she said. It's a choice that every generation who's decided to work with Russell's has made. You just can't stay away. Gerrymandering in New England? Experts weigh in on debate. This story is by Margie Cullen, USA Today Network, New England. As redistricting wars raged across the country, the Trump administration has repeatedly accused New England Democrats of gerrymandering their state. Reminder, even though nearly half of New England is conservative Republican, Democrats have gerrymandered the GOP to zero House seats in the entire region, Trump aide Stephen Miller said on social media May 7th. The gerrymander was indeed born in New England in 1812 when Massachusetts Governor Eldridge Gerry approved a salamander-shaped district drawn to give his party an advantage. And it's true that no state in New England currently has a single Republican representative. But does that mean it's gerrymandered? It's a pretty strong no, Chris Kenney, a postdoctoral scholar at Princeton University and a founding member of the Algorithm-Assisted Redistricting Methodology, ALARM, project said. While it's true that much of the Northeast has states that are about 60% Democratic and 40% Republican, New England's unique geography naturally creates Democratic districts. Rather than a few big blue cities surrounded by redland, you've got all these dots of kind of mini-cities that lean blue, surrounded by these pink areas, Kenny described. The result is at least light blue districts everywhere. Is it possible to draw a Republican district in Massachusetts? In Massachusetts, congressional districts, which must be contiguous and have equal populations, are drawn every 10 years by the state legislature. In 2021, Massachusetts' current map was approved by a majority of Massachusetts' Republican lawmakers, and then Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican, signed it into law. The maps were created shortly after a 2019 paper from Tufts University found that it was physically impossible to draw a Republican district in Massachusetts. Now, that's no longer exactly the case, but it's still very unlikely. Princeton's ALARM project used algorithms to draw 5,000 realistic simulated congressional maps for every state. The simulations generally respect county and municipal lines, consider each state's rules, and don't take partisanship into account. In Massachusetts, the algorithm created only 3 maps out of 5,000, less than 1%, that would have yielded a Trump-won district in the 2024 election. The districts centered around the southern area of the state, which includes Fall River, Taunton, and New Bedford. But even these districts would only have carried Trump by less than a point, an advantage that might not hold for the congressional race when you consider the incumbency advantage and the fact that the 2024 election swung more towards Republican than usual. Ben Schneer, an associate professor of public policy at Harvard Kennedy School, said that you can draw a stronger Republican district that stretches from South Shore, from the South Shore to the middle of the state west of Worcester. But this map would split up counties and towns, which is against the typical standards for nonpartisan districts. What about other New England states? The situation is similar in other New England states. In Connecticut, simulated plans found Democrats winning 4.1 to 4.9 out of the state's five congressional seats on average. In Rhode Island, 100% of the simulated plans found both of its districts going to Democrats. Vermont, the country's bluest state, has just one statewide district because of its small population. New Hampshire and Maine have more even split of Democrats and Republicans, and their current congressional maps reflect that. New Hampshire's first congressional district and Maine's second congressional district are both rated R+2 by the Cook Political Report. While they're currently represented by Democrats, strong Republican candidates could win there, Kenny said. Would maps be based on proportionality rather, or excuse me, should maps be based on proportionality rather than geography? In 2025, both President Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance accused Massachusetts directly of being gerrymandered. Democrats have gerrymandered their states, Vance said in an interview with NBC. Massachusetts, where 32% of the residents in Massachusetts voted for Republicans, zero federal Republican representatives. In the academic world, Vance's argument is described as a proportionality standard. It's another way of thinking about gerrymandering, but neither Kenny nor Schneer find it convincing. Take the more solid potential Trump district in Massachusetts, Schneer said. This map might give Republicans a seat, giving the state some proportionality, but it would include two different areas of the state with different needs. Kenny said there's research that suggests that when geography is ignored and towns are split into different districts, the towns get worse representation and less federal funding. There's some benefit to knowing who your member of Congress is, Kenny said. He compared it to New England's parliamentary system, which splits seats proportionally to vote share. Some of the more complicated systems, where you might not be geographically attached, and you have six different people that represent you, and you're not sure any of them are going to be responsive to you, comes with its own costs. And despite arguments from the administration, the redistricting craze is not bringing the U.S. closer to proportionality anyways. Instead, Schneer said, we seem to be heading toward a world where, in most states, one party wins a narrow majority of votes and gets all or most of the seats, similar to how the Electoral College works, which is ultimately bad for democracy or bad for the function of the House of Representatives, because the whole purpose of the House of Representatives was to be more proportional and to provide district-based representation for specific geographies and communities, Schneer said. Will New England redraw their maps? Over the past year, eight states have redrawn their congressional districts in search of a political edge. Texas's new maps would gain Republicans five more seats, while California's map would net Democrats five seats. New lines in six states are designed to imperil incumbent House Democrats in Florida, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, and Tennessee, while a map that would flip up to four GOP-held seats in Virginia was rejected by the state Supreme Court. The current redistricting battle is unprecedented in its scale and extremity, Schneer said, and right now Republicans are winning. But he thinks it's unlikely that New England does the same thing anytime soon. New Hampshire Republicans floated the idea of redistricting to make one of the state's House districts even more favorable toward the GOP, but Republican Governor Kelly Ayotte squashed the idea. As for the rest of the states, it's kind of squeezing a rock, Schneer said. They're already all going in one direction, except for Maine. But he can see it happening eventually, especially if the states start redrawing their maps more frequently than the traditional once a decade. I mean, why stop at once a decade, right? Why not adjust the map before every election to try to make sure your party is going to maintain all the seats, right? He said. It gets reduced to absurdity, but I think maybe that's where we're headed. Now let's take a short break.
Are you or a loved one losing your vision? Mass Commission for the Blind can help reclaim your independence with new skills and assistive technologies. Partner with Mass Commission for the Blind to develop your vision for the future. If you're blind or visually impaired, find out if you're eligible to register for services to help you achieve your career and life goals. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCD. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 21 minutes past the hour. Three charged in theft of dump truck. This story is by Norman Miller, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. A Marlboro man and two others are accused of stealing a dump truck in Marlboro before leading police in Maine on a chase that ended when a cruiser was rammed, authorities said. Police in Lewiston, Maine, arrested Antonio Morales Piojan, 23, of Marlboro, Angelica Almeida, 20, of Lawrence, and Stephen Grossi, 37, of Lowell, shortly after 8 p.m. on Friday. The trio were allegedly in a Ford F-350 dump truck stolen from Marlboro earlier that day, according to Lewiston police. Marlboro Police Captain Robert Jessome said that at 5:16 a.m. Friday, a local landscaping company owner reported his truck stolen from a parking lot at 301 Maple Street, which is Route 85. The owner said he parked the 2012 Ford F-350 at 5:30 p.m. Thursday. A friend reported seeing the vehicle at 10:30 p.m., but it was gone by 5:16 a.m. Friday. Excuse me. The truck was also towing a trailer that contained nearly $10,000 worth of landscaping tools, such as weed trimmers, hedge trimmers, and other tools, Jessome said. At the time, police had no suspects and used flock safety cameras to search for the license plate. They still could not find it, the captain said. However, just before 8 p.m. in Lewiston, police received an alert of a stolen vehicle on their flock camera system, according to a Lewiston police Facebook post. Upon locating the truck, officers attempted to stop it. The vehicle entered a small parking lot and was trapped. According to the post, the truck, driven by Pijohan, then intentionally rammed a police cruiser, totaling the vehicle. According to the Facebook post, the truck drove away but later crashed into a fence and became disabled. Officers caught all three suspects as they tried to run from the vehicle. One officer suffered a large cut on his head when it came into contact with a mangled fence. He had to get 7 staples in his head, according to the post. Lewiston police believe the suspects, all from Massachusetts, were in Lewiston to continue their crime spree, according to the Facebook post. Police charged Pijohan with reckless conduct, aggravated criminal mischief, refusing to submit to arrest, leaving the scene of a crash, theft by receiving stolen property, and theft by unauthorized use of property. Almeida and Grossi were charged with theft by unauthorized use of property and possession of stolen property. Grossi was also charged with refusing to submit to arrest. Drissome said the Marlborough police have not charged the trio, but they will likely be facing numerous charges connected to the theft of the truck and the landscaping tools. Pijoan, Almeida, and Grossi were each arraigned Tuesday in Lewiston District Court. Results were not updated in the computer system as of midday Wednesday, according to the court's clerk's office. New York ban on 3D printed guns sparks debate. The story is by Brianna J. Frank, USA Today. New York Governor Kathy Hochul signed into law on May 27th a requirement for 3D printers sold in the state to have technology preventing them from printing guns. Supporters describe it as a first-of-its-kind provision that could reduce gun violence, but critics say such technology impedes free expression. The provision was introduced as part of the state's proposed 2026-27 budget, which the state legislature approved on May 21st. The law requires all 3D printers sold in the state to have blocking technology, which could be hardware, software, firmware, or other measures, to keep printers from making guns or illegal gun parts. Violating the law could result in a civil penalty with a $5,000 fine per product sold. Groups including the National Rifle Association and the Electronic Frontier Foundation have raised concerns about the law, in part on First Amendment grounds. This is ultimately asking tools not to work for the creator and go through a filter, a censorship filter, Rory Meir, the Electronic Frontier Foundation's Director of Open Access and Tech Community Engagement, told USA Today. Sabrina Briere, Hochul's Deputy Secretary for Public Safety, said constitutional concerns are always in our mind. The New York Police Department recovered one 3D-printed ghost gun in 2021, Manhattan District Attorney's Office spokesperson Manaya Lin said. The number rose to 4 in 2022, 42 in 2023, and 109 in 2024. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg said in a May 22nd post on X that passing the legislation was a major step forward for public safety. Sam Levy, the director of policy advocacy at Every Town for Gun Safety, said the capabilities of 3D printers now compared to a decade ago are miles apart, adding that there is a much higher degree of lethality and reliability with 3D printers today. Giffords, a gun violence prevention and advocacy organization established by former Representative Gabby Giffords after she survived an assassination attempt in 2011, also supported the New York measure, as well as similar ones in states including California and Washington. The new law establishes a working group comprised of experts in topics including additive manufacturing technology, artificial intelligence, and public safety. The group is tasked with making recommendations on minimum safety standards for 3D printers to comply with the law based on existing technology. If the group determines New York's requirement is not technologically feasible, the law states, it will report its finding and no regulation shall be required to be promulgated until such time as the working group determines that it is technologically feasible. Levy said it would likely be around 3 years before the requirements would go into effect in the state. Family-run cheese shop in North Grafton closes. This story is by Sarah Barnacle, Worcester Telegram and Gazette, USA Today Network. After 16 years in business, Pecorino Cheese Shop has made the difficult decision to close its doors at the end of July. Owners of the family-run business located on Route 30 described the country cheese shop as having a European flair and shared the news on social media May 6th that the last day it will be open is July 31st. Owner Simone Linsen grew up in a small town outside Heidelberg, Germany, and moved to the United States more than three decades ago. Pecorino became a brainchild of all the things I love: Europe, good food and wine, people, entertaining, decorating, she said. I opened the store in late summer of 2010, and thankfully was able to capture the interest of the community immediately. The business was a success from the start and grew into a scope I never imagined. The shop carried anywhere from 60 to 80 cheeses from both local farmsteads and European producers. Every piece is cut to order and can be paired along with several other items lining the shop's walls, from cured meats, fresh olives, spreads, jams, honeys, crackers, and other traditional cheese board items. The shop also hosts a number of events, from wine tastings to private events for small groups. We are looking forward to the coming weeks to serve you with deepest gratitude and a full heart, Linsen shared on social media. Ideally, she said, the shop would have stayed open, exchanging hands to a new owner. But after months of navigating potential sales, Linsen said she saw no other option but to close for good. Next, she plans to retire in Italy with her husband, where they've restored an old farmhouse and have been growing their own olives to make olive oil. We are hoping for a peaceful, simpler life, close to nature, and I look forward to being near my family again, she said. As for the remainder of the summer, Linsen said she plans to wind down inventory come June with several goodbye parties planned. In July, the shop plans to sell off the future, I think that's supposed to be furniture, displays, and decor before closing the final week of July. We are humbled and grateful for the support we received in all these years, she said. The reaction and love we received after our announcement is overwhelming, and it will take time to respond to all the personal messages, emails, phone calls, and comments on social media. We want everyone to know that we worked tirelessly to have the store live on, but too many moving and intertwined parts did not align for us in the end. Life goes on, and my heart is full for what we've had together with Pecorino. And now let's pause for a short break.
Hello, sports fans. Did you know that Audio Journal has a weekly one-hour program that features news and inspiring stories about disabled and visually impaired folks participating in sports at the local, national, and international level? That's AJ Sports Page. Tune in on Fridays from 5 to 6 p.m. That's AJ Sports Page, airing every Friday from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Archived episodes are available on demand on our website, www.audiojournal.org. That's AJ Sports Page, a production of Audio Journal. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 34 minutes past the hour. U.S. may renew Iran strikes if no deal. Hegseth states support for Asia-Pacific region. The United States is ready to restart attacks on Iran if a deal cannot be reached, Secretary of War Pete Hegseth said on May 30th, as negotiators from Washington and Tehran worked to bridge major differences blocking an agreement. Our ability to recommence if necessary, we are more than capable, Hegseth said in Singapore. Our stockpiles are more than suited for that, both there and around the globe, so we are in a very good place, he added. Hegseth, speaking at the Shangri-La Dialogue, Asia's premier forum for defense leaders, militaries, and diplomats, said the United States has not turned its back on the Asia-Pacific region, despite being engaged in conflict with Iran. We can do two things at one time. We are supercharging our defense industrial base so that we are building two times, three times, four times the munition very soon to ensure that all of our operations plans are properly funded throughout the world, he said. Hegseth said President Donald Trump was patient and wants to make a great deal that ensures Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. On May 29th, Trump said he would meet in a secure White House room to make a final determination on a proposal to end the Iran war, which would extend an early April truce for another 60 days, giving negotiators time to forge a permanent end to the conflict. Mohsen Rezai, an advisor to Iran's supreme leader Mojtaba Khamenei, said on May 30th that Trump was betraying diplomacy for a third time by continuing a naval blockade imposed on Iran and making what he described as excessive demands in negotiations. The war launched by the United States and Israel on February 28th has killed thousands of people, mainly in Iran and Lebanon, and caused global economic pain by pushing up energy prices due to Iran's effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Meanwhile, the U.S. military said it fired a missile into the engine room of a vessel trying to get through the U.S. blockade of Iran on May 29th. In a statement on May 30th, U.S. Central Command said it fired a Hellfire missile into the engine room of the Gambia-flagged Leon Star as it was transitioning international waters toward an Iranian port on the Gulf of Oman. Before the attack, U.S. forces issued more than 20 warnings informing the vessel it was in violation of the U.S. blockade, according to CENTCOM. CENTCOM said the ship was no longer transitioning to Iran, but did not provide any further details. Since the blockade started April 13th, the U.S. military has redirected at least 115 ships, CENTCOM said on May 29th. In addition, Oman's Maritime Security Center on May 30th urged seafarers, fishermen, and vessels to exercise utmost caution after a floating object suspected to be a naval mine was sighted west of the inshore traffic zone in the Strait of Hormuz within Omani territorial waters. The center advised maritime users to keep a safe distance from any suspicious objects and to report them immediately to the relevant authorities. Judge orders review of Trump settlement. $10 billion lawsuit against IRS under scrutiny. The story is by David Shepherdson, Reuters. A U.S. judge in Florida said she will review a deal between the Justice Department and President Donald Trump to settle his $10 billion lawsuit against the Internal Revenue Service, intensifying scrutiny of the heavily criticized agreement. Trump filed the lawsuit against his own government over an alleged mishandling of his tax records that resulted in leaks to the media. The proposed agreement would create a $1.8 billion fund to compensate victims of political weaponization. U.S. District Judge Kathleen Williams ordered Trump's lawyers on May 29th to respond by June 12th to a motion filed by 35 retired federal judges alleging that the settlement is a product of collusion and is itself a fraud on the court, and to address the question of whether the case should be reopened over the contention the lawsuit was the result of deception by Trump and the government. Following the settlement, Trump moved to dismiss the lawsuit in a bid to prevent any judicial scrutiny of the deal. Williams initially granted the dismissal on May 18th, but her new order said the court is empowered to investigate serious misconduct. It is unusual for a judge to order the government to respond to a motion after a case has been dismissed. If the judge reopens the case, she could order a hearing or take further action. The retired judges said in the settlement, which was never placed before the court, raises profound questions about Trump and the government's actions and manipulation of the judicial system, which threatens to undermine confidence in the administration of justice. Separately, U.S. District Judge Liane Brinkema in Virginia on May 29th temporarily blocked the Trump administration from setting up the anti-weaponization fund. Brinkema's order will remain in effect until at least June 12th. The fund spurred a backlash, even from some lawmakers in Trump's Republican Party, who expressed anger that some people who attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, could receive taxpayer-funded payouts. It was derided by some critics as a slush fund. The settlement would also bar the IRS from pursuing any audits into past tax claims for Trump, his relatives, and his companies for any tax returns filed before May 18th, or for any matters that were raised or could have been raised. Legal experts describe the arrangement as highly unusual, both because of the nature of Trump's lawsuit against the IRS and because funds of this scale typically are either created by an act of Congress or supervised by a court. Harvard ranked top Massachusetts law school. This story is by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, New England. Thinking about a career in law? Harvard University ranks as the best law school in Massachusetts and number six nationally, according to U.S. News and World Report. In total, eight Massachusetts law schools made the 2026 list. The esteemed Cambridge institution has an acceptance rate of 9.2%, a median LSAT score of 174 out of 180, and a total enrollment of 1,796 students. Full-time tuition is $78,692. The school has a student-to-faculty ratio of about 6.9 to 1, and 97.9% of Harvard students pass the bar exam on their first attempt. To get these rankings, U.S. News surveyed nearly 200 American Bar Association accredited law schools in late 2025 and early 2026. The rankings are primarily based on employment outcomes, with the remainder reflecting faculty resources, student credentials, and professional assignments. Here are Massachusetts' top law schools according to the 2026 U.S. News and World Report rankings. Harvard University is number one. Number six nationally. Number two, Boston College. Number 20 nationally. Number three, Boston University. Number 24 nationally. Number four, Northeastern University. Number 77 nationally. Number five is Suffolk University. Number 128 nationally. Number six, Western New England University. Number 159 nationally. Number seven, New England Law, Boston. Number 168 nationally. Number 8, University of Massachusetts Dartmouth, number 171 nationally. And these are the nation's top law schools according to the 2026 U.S. News and World Report rankings. Number one, Stanford University. Number two, University of Chicago, tied for number two. Number three, Yale University, tied for number two. Number four, University of Pennsylvania, tied for number four. Number five, University of Virginia, tied for number four. And number six, Harvard University. Number seven, Duke University, tied for number seven. Number eight, New York University, tied for number seven. Number nine, Columbia University, tied for number nine. Number 10, Northwestern University, tied for number nine. And number 11, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, also tied for number nine. And now let's pause for a short break.
Audio Journal, the radio reading service of Central Massachusetts, is your best source for news, information, and entertainment for individuals who are blind or otherwise unable to access print material. We are a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like to know our broadcast schedule, go to the Audio Journal website at www.audiojournal.org or contact us and we'll gladly send you a large print or braille program guide. Call 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. Audio Journal connects listeners to their local communities. Have you heard the news? Make sure everyone knows you heard it on Audio Journal.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 46 minutes past the hour. Keefe Regional Technical School awards 205 diplomas. This story is by Joanna K. Tsouvelis, Wicked Local, USA Today Network. The 205 members of Keefe Regional Technical School's class of 2026 collected their diplomas as part of the school's 53rd generation ceremony on Wednesday, May 27th, at the Warren Conference Center and Inn. The vocational school, which serves students from Ashland, Framingham, Holliston, Hopkinton, and Natick, sits at the corner of Winter and Fountain Streets near downtown Framingham. But like it has in other recent years, its graduation ceremony took place on a section of the 100 wooded lakefront acres encompassing the Warren Center. Longtime Superintendent Director Jonathan Evans proudly announced that 61% of this year's graduates will attend college, including at Boston University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Clark University, Culinary Institute of America, Smith College, Quinnipiac University, and Northeastern University, and the University of New Hampshire. As we celebrate your plans, you clearly demonstrated that when you decided to come to Keefe Tech, no doors were closed on your future, Evans said. In addition, 50 class members have already been hired from companies including Milton Caterpillar in Milford, Joseph Kaufman Plumbing and Heating in Framingham, Hamilton Hair Studio in Hopkinton, Brian A. Keefe Electrical in Ashland, Christos Automotive in Natick, according to Evans. Valedictorian Jessica Lynn Zanshi, who will study computer science at MIT this fall, reflected on the challenges of the past 4 years that felt like a lifetime. Through it all, I think it is safe to say that none of us were ever alone, she said. We showed up for each other. In shop, in the classroom, when we needed each other the most. Zanchi's advice for her classmates is to live each day as it comes. You won't get anywhere by worrying about the next problem you have to face, she said. She also advised classmates to carry the best of their high school years with them. Remember the people who made the difficult days easier and the ordinary moments exciting. Salutatorian Victoria Silveira Grauman used the metaphor of diamond in the rough about how the prettiest of jewels can start out as rough and dull-looking minerals deep beneath the earth's crust, only to turn into breathtaking works of nature once they're dug up, polished, and refined. People tend to fawn over the beauty part, but do we properly appreciate the wonder of the hard work, patience, and pure grit it takes to get to the outwardly beautiful result? Grauman said, I know my jewel didn't start out pretty. She reflected on the flaws and mistakes she made along the way, but realized she was learning and growing when she applied herself. I encourage you all, dig inside of yourself and find your inner jewel where your potential lies, Grauman said. Natick police officer linked to domestic assault in Holliston. This story is by Norman Miller, Metro West Daily News, USA Today. A Natick police officer facing charges connected to an alleged domestic assault in Holliston is scheduled for trial next month. Jackson Dwyer appeared Wednesday, May 27th, in Framingham District Court for a pre-trial conference. Judge David Kunis set his bench trial for June 15th. A bench trial is when a judge hears and decides the case, rather than a jury. Dwyer is charged with strangulation, domestic assault and battery, and intimidation of a witness. Holliston police arrested Dwyer on April 25th after an alleged domestic incident. He has been placed on paid administrative leave from the Natick Police Department due to the arrest. The department is conducting an internal affairs investigation into the incident, Deputy Police Chief Brian Lauzon said. The state's Peace Officers Standards and Training Post Commission has also suspended Dwyer, meaning that even if Natick lifts its leave, he still cannot work as a police officer. Dwyer can appeal the suspension to the entire post commission or a hearing officer. Dwyer pleaded not guilty during his arraignment on April 27th in Framingham District. He was released without bail and ordered not to abuse the alleged victim and not to possess any dangerous weapons. Survey reveals perspectives relating to dating and money. This story is by Dennis P. Carmody, Asbury Park Press, USA Today Network, New Jersey. Would you go on a date just to get a free meal out of it? If so, you're not alone. According to a survey of more than 1,500 American adults by financial services company J.G. Wentworth, 39.9% of those who responded said they have done just that. The survey found that 27.5% haven't done it but would consider it, while 32.6% have never even considered the idea. That's one of the multiple findings about the confluence of dating and money. The survey discovered the average amount spent on a first date is $93, while most expect their dating partner to spend an average of $92 on that first meeting. Talk about spending much more than that, and people get nervous. When asked if they'd still be happy to go on a date that would cost $100 or more, the survey found 13.4% said they definitely would, but 43.9% said they would hesitate, and 39.3% said they would probably skip the date. There is some question as to where all that money is going, however, because the survey found that the top three date activities were getting a drink at a bar, 37.5%, enjoying a board game at night, 35.5%, and taking a walk in the park, 8.2%. More expensive choices like dinner at a restaurant, going to the movies, or taking part in activities like ice skating or bowling fell below 5%. The survey did not ask how much people might spend on clothes or primping prior to a first date. Hooters to close Shrewsbury location, one of four in Massachusetts. The story is by the TNG staff, Worcester Telegram and Gazette, USA Today Network. Hooters Shrewsbury is closing, the restaurant announced on social media. After much consideration, we have made the difficult decision to close our Shrewsbury location. These decisions are never easy, and we want to sincerely thank the Shrewsbury community for years of support, memories, and loyalty, the restaurant posted Wednesday afternoon, May 27th. The post did not announce when the location will close. The Shrewsbury location was one of four in Massachusetts. It opened at 291 Boston Turnpike, Route 9, in December 2015. The spot next to Fairlawn Plaza was once a Chili's restaurant. And that's about all the time we have for this edition of the Metro West Daily News. You have been listening to a reading of the Metro West Daily News for Sunday, May 31st, 2026. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Craig Fife, and I thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. A city lake may seem quiet and still at first, but with a little time, you might start to hear its music. Female wood ducks call out to each other, keeping an eye out for predators. Red-winged blackbirds sing from the cattails. The males perch high on the stems and show off their red shoulder patches, while the females search for food deep in the undergrowth. A belted kingfisher flies the length of the shoreline, rattling and diving at small fish. Several pairs of mallards paddle around the shallows, quacking companionably as they dunk their heads in the water looking for food. From a woody thicket along the bank, male song sparrows belt out their chorus all day long. But when a red-tailed hawk passes overhead, everyone falls silent. Stick around long enough, and the music will begin again. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Remmel. This episode is brought to you by Teton Science Schools, specializing in outdoor learning experiences and education in Grand Teton National Park. More at tetonscience.org.
This is not a public service announcement. This is a one-minute mystery.
A man walked into the Salty Dog Tavern and ordered a fish fillet sandwich, a glass of dark rum, and some female company. The proprietor turned to him and said, "Look, sailor, the first two requests are no problem, but the third request is out of my hands." What made the proprietor think the man was a sailor?
And here's the solution to our mystery.
The man was wearing a sailor's uniform.
And now back to our regular programming.